It's the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. Thank you for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Today, we'll look at a practice that's been somewhat controversial over the years, hypnosis. Using suggestive images to help curb things like chronic pain and depression. But first, we'll look at another useful function of the mind, empathy. Empathy, the ability to put yourself in someone else's shoes to get a better understanding of what they're feeling or thinking, is a key ingredient to successful relationships. But studies show that being empathetic doesn't just improve relationships. It reduces prejudice and racism, decreases bullying, encourages us to help others, and promotes tolerance and emotional well-being. Roman Kaczmarek is an international expert on the topic and believes that the development and practice of empathy is key to making the world a better place. He's explored empathy's roots and studied it from historic, social, and scientific perspectives. He's a founding member of the School of Life in London and advises organizations, including the United Nations, on using empathy and conversation to create social change. He's the author of Wonderbox and How to Find Fulfilling Work. His latest book, out in paperback, is Empathy, Why It Matters, and How to Get It. Roman Kaczmarek lives in London and joins us today by Skype. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me on.
What is empathy really? And I know I just described it, but I think I mean that in a deeper sense. I can imagine there are people who could translate this as taking on everyone's problems. That's not possible, and that's not what you're suggesting.
Now, there are a lot of confusions about what empathy really means. Some people confuse it with sympathy, which is really just about pitying someone or feeling sorry for them. It's not really about making the empathy leap, where you really try and understand, well, what is it like to be another person? What's it like to be a five-year-old child struggling with bullying in the playground? What's it like to be a homeless guy sleeping out on the streets on a cold winter's night? And empathy is about that leap of trying to understand the perspective of the other person, but it isn't necessarily about, you know, taking on all of their emotional baggage. In fact, there's two kinds of empathy. One's called affective empathy, which is about resonating with someone's emotions. So you see anguish on someone's face and you feel it as well. But then there's something called cognitive empathy, which is about really trying to step into their shoes, to get inside their skin. And that's not nearly such an emotional overload.
Survival is at our very core. How can we look at empathy in the face of survival? And I'm thinking here about the migrant crisis that's happening now.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, when I think of survival, I think, well, what is it that makes us human? And a lot of people think, okay, human beings are essentially self-interested, individualistic creatures. But of course, we're also wired for social cooperation and mutual aid. And it's empathy which creates the bonds between people. It's really part of what makes us human. We're both serpents and doves. And when you think of the migrant crisis in Europe and other countries, well, this is really about trying to use empathy to try and take the perspective of another person and realize that we should be in relation with them, that, you know, someone who's fleeing a war in Syria is another person, like your neighbor, like your child, another human being. And empathy really is ultimately about humanizing, saying that somebody else is of the same value as us. So it's making that empathic connection, which is the basis of, you know, surviving as a cooperative society.
How does that help the situation?
It's really fascinating, actually. I think that, you know, we've been so bombarded by images of people suffering from around the world that often we just switch off and our empathy gets overloaded by this influx of images and news stories and statistics. But sometimes it breaks through. So that famously, you know, not long ago, there was a photograph in newspapers around the world of a three-year-old child, you know, washed up on a Turkish beach, a Syrian child. And that sparked people's empathic minds, allowed them to stop for a moment and focus and think, well, what is it like to be a migrant who's fleeing a war or who's got nowhere to live, who can't survive in all sorts of ways? And I think the power of the media today is essential in spreading the empathy message across borders, so that we don't just empathize with our nearest and dearest people in our own community, but we stretch the empathic bonds across, you know, national boundaries.
You talk about your own experiences, you know, traveling and some of the things that you've seen. It must be very difficult and maybe even cause overload at some point. When you're looking at very impoverished parts of the world, how do we deal with that? What do we do with it?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, my own experience, relatively small, is working in humanitarian aid in Central America and in Guatemala, and being in villages of refugees and indigenous people where people were, dying of hunger and malnutrition and things like that. And what I learned, and also from observing people who work in very distressing situations, for example, humanitarian aid workers or nurses working on cancer wards or with terminally ill people, is that you need to sometimes step back a little bit so you don't have that emotional overload. And people working those situations, they don't, if you work on a suicide call line, you don't work 12 hours straight without a break. You step back and you know where your own limits are. And for example, doctors, they're always switching between the two types of empathy, the affective and the cognitive. So they may be listening to a patient, and rather than just getting overloaded by that person's emotional pain, they try and step back and think, well, what does this person really need medically, psychologically, and so on? So I think we're always in a dance between the two kinds of empathy.
How can we use empathy with a group like ISIS? Is there a place for empathy there?
It's a really tricky question. I think we need to be incredibly open-minded about this. If you think of somewhere like in Britain, for example, where 20 years ago, people in Britain could never have imagined that the politicians would sit down at the same table as members of the IRA, so-called terrorists from the Irish Republican Army. And yet, in the last decade, there's been a breakthrough where the IRA started to become willing to talk, and people who were once branded terrorists were in conversation with the politicians and others, and that's what led to a lot of the peace breakthroughs in Northern Ireland. So at the moment, we can't quite imagine talking to people from ISIS, partly because they don't want to talk to us or leaders of the West and so on. But I think we need to be open to having conversations, even with those people whose views we may violently disagree with, and ultimately not want to see their point of view. I think we need to struggle and meet that challenge of trying to see how they see the world. It doesn't mean we have to agree with them, but I think we're going to be a lot smarter in our strategies to deal with ISIS and other terrorist organizations if we try and see their perspective. What is really driving them? Is it because they are really just evil, demented people, or is it because actually they feel that they're being colonized by the West? Or actually, a lot of young people who join ISIS, of course, are coming from problems of unemployment and structural poverty, which is what's driving them. We need to understand all of this, and empathy can help.
I know you advise the United Nations on using empathy in conversation for social change. Have you been asked to help get those conversations started?
Not in those ones in particular, though. I've had a lot of been involved in a lot of different peace building projects in various ways. So, for example, in Northern Ireland, being part of conversations between, for example, an IRA terrorist who planted a bomb that tried to blow up the former British Prime Minister and someone whose father was killed by that bomb. And it's an incredibly intimate and delicate thing being involved in those conversations, but it's remarkable how open people can be. When you bring people in the same room who may have, on paper or rhetorically hate each other, when they see eye to eye and they hear each other's stories, it's an amazingly healing thing, although, of course, it's very complex.
This is Roman Kuznarek, and we're talking about his latest book called Empathy: Why It Matters and How to Get It. You say we have a spreading worldwide empathy deficit. Do you feel like the tide might be changing? There are so many intimate personal stories being reported. I'm thinking about the Oral History Project StoryCorps, and so many public radio programs and podcasts really focusing on the personal experience. And so I'm wondering, do you think we're becoming more empathetic?
Yeah, I think in general, what the data tends to be showing, if you look at the psychology studies and so on, is that empathy is on the decline. So a very famous study from the University of Michigan showed that empathy levels amongst US college students have dropped by nearly 50% in the last 3 decades, and the steepest decline in the last 10 years. On the other hand, we're seeing incredible initiatives to spread empathy. And I think there is what I think of as a revolutionary movement, not a revolution of new political institutions, but of human relationships going on. One part of the evidence for that is the teaching of empathy in schools. And there's a program that started in Canada called Roots of Empathy, which is now in the US and Germany, Australia, the UK, other places. Nearly 750,000 children have done it. And the way it works is that a baby is brought into the classroom of like elementary school kids, and the kids sit around the baby. They start talking about the baby. Why is the baby crying? Why is the baby laughing? What's she thinking or feeling? They try and step into the baby's shoes and see the world through the baby's eyes. And they use that as a jumping off point for then talking about, well, what's it like to be a kid bullied in the playground, or a child in a wheelchair, or a young person living on the streets of Calcutta? And these programs are really good at increasing empathy and social cooperation and reducing bullying. So I think there's a revolutionary wave there. But I think you're right to pick up on the importance of radio, things like StoryCorps, a whole load of narrative storytelling projects which are opening our empathic minds. Of course, they're not new in some ways. Go back to the great Chicago oral historian Studs Terkel, who was doing empathy-based interviews, over 9,000 of them for nearly 50 years, and publishing books as well, fabulous books like Race and Working, which I think open up the importance of hearing the individual voice of people, whether it's a janitor or a senator. And those things really make a difference. And I've recently launched a new project called the Empathy Museum in London, which tries to do something similar using audio.
Yes, can you talk about your project?
Yes, yeah, so the Empathy Museum is designed as a kind of adventure space for expanding empathic potential. And we just had our first exhibit in London in September this year, and it was called A Mile in My Shoes. And it was directed by a quite a famous ecological and community artist called Claire Patey. And I'm the founder of the Empathy Museum. And what happened is that you would go along to a giant shoebox, which was on the banks of the River Thames in London. And you would walk in, and it was an alternative empathy shoe shop. Someone would fit you with a pair of shoes, literally your size 4, size 11, whatever you happen to be. And those shoes would belong to a stranger. It could be someone who has just being released from prison after 15 years, or a bearded drag queen, or someone who works in the sewers, or somebody whose child was just killed in a tragic accident. And you literally go out and walk a mile in their shoes while listening to an audio narrative of them talking about their life. And it's a very simple but powerful way of bringing that metaphor of walking a mile in someone's shoes to actual reality. And it's very intimate. You slip on someone's shoes and you get kind of a shiver through your body. In fact, I'm feeling it right now as I talk to you, thinking about putting on the shoes of a man who'd been put in prison for a crime he didn't commit, so he said. And it's an incredibly empathic, immersive action to take part in.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from this project?
It's curious. People from all around the world came to it, whether it was German language students or management consultants on staff days out. And the variety of responses was really, really interesting. One of the nicest moments, just the first day that the exhibit opened, was when a group of deaf students came along. And one person, I saw them walking off down the riverside, and one of them was listening to the audio, someone who could hear, and they were signing the audio to their deaf partner. And it was a wonderful kind of empathic interaction, which, of course, what the whole Empathy Museum was about. So it was quite a thrilling thing to see things that you didn't expect were going to happen actually happen.
We live in a very obviously technological world that gives us the opportunity to connect with people on a global scale, which seems like it would increase our empathic capabilities, but you say that's actually not the case.
Yes, the sad story is that although there are 2.7 billion people online, the great empathy revolution hasn't yet happened. Because you would think, with this ability to contact people on Skype or Google Hangouts, other means, we could be bridging all sorts of incredible divides. But what we find, of course, is that online culture is full of harassment and abuse. 73% of people in the United States say they've experienced online abuse in the last 12 months. Part of the problem there, of course, is about the anonymous nature of online culture, that you can say something without looking them in the eye. On the other hand, there are wonderful projects which are starting to reveal that we're getting better at using digital technology for building empathy. So there's a great project which gets elders living in care homes in Chicago to teach English to teenagers in Brazil. And the Brazilian teenagers want native English teachers, and the elders living in the care home, the retirement home, don't want to be lonely anymore and want to make a friend.
What a wonderful project.
It's absolutely wonderful. It's so simple. You would think there'd be millions of things like this, and they are growing. And I think it tells us something about the potential of face-to-face contact. I mean, recently Mark Zuckerberg announced that Facebook was going to introduce an alternative button to the like button, a kind of an empathy button he started talking about, which might be a way of signaling, if someone says that their mother has just died, you don't want to say like, you want to press something else. You might want to press an empathy button. I'm not sure this is going to, again, create a wave of empathic change. I'm slightly worried that an empathy button is going to make us a bit more emotionally inarticulate or illiterate, and you just do a quick click and that's enough empathy for the day. So
Right.
I'm keeping my eye out on that.
Roman, are there some countries where empathy is more prevalent than others? And where do the United States and Europe fall on the empathy scale?
Yeah, a lot of the international comparisons, I think the data's not very strong. I think what you notice certainly is a steeper decline of empathy in the United States compared to European countries, though there's falls in Europe. And you see some countries appear to have more empathy than others. I mean, just look at the migrant crisis in Europe, where a country like
Germany.
Germany is much more willing to take in migrants than a country like England, where there's much more xenophobia and prejudice around immigration, refugees, and asylum seekers. So you see an empathy difference there. And then you go somewhere like Brazil, which is a very curious country where people tend to be very emotionally open. When two people greet each other, they hug and kiss, and you can't tell whether they're best friends or they're strangers. They do it all in the same way. There seems to be a lot of that emotional or affective empathy. On the other hand, it's a country where walk around Rio and you see luxury apartment blocks right next to shanty towns or favelas, and you see huge inequalities. So I think in any one country, it's very hard to make a blanket statement and say, well, the Brazilians are highly empathic. I think there's always a lot of contradiction in any one country or any one community. Though I think, what's really important is this ability to try and talk to strangers and to make those conversations where you get over divides. And I found when I used to live in New England, actually, that people were very good at talking to strangers, much more so than in a country like Finland, a country that's famous for people being actually kind of reticent and not talking very much on the park bench.
This is Roman Kaczmarek. He's the author of this book out in paperback called Empathy. It explores the concept of empathy and its importance on social and political change, as well as on an emotional level. We're going to pause here and take a quick break and continue our conversation when we come back. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith, and we've been talking with Roman Kaczmarek about his latest book called Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. It's out in paperback, and it explores the concept of empathy and its importance for social and political change. Roman, you give a striking example of how being empathetic can make a huge difference. This one had to do with a former member of the Ku Klux Klan.
It's a very famous example of empathic divides being bridged, which I think is very important. It actually happened in 1971 when a guy called Claiborne Paul Ellis, who was a member of the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina, was at a community meeting with an African American civil rights activist who he hated with a passion, called Ann Atwater. He really obviously couldn't stand this person as a KKK leader, but he had to work together with Ann Atwater on a community project to tackle race problems in schools. And what actually happened in this very famous 10-day community meeting in 1971 was that C.P. Ellis started realizing he had a lot in common with Ann Atwater. They both shared the oppression of poverty, for example. She was working as a domestic cleaner, and he was working as a janitor at Duke University. And Studs Terkel, who we mentioned before, famously wrote about this couple, about how what happened after the meeting was that Claiborne Paul Ellis, he realized Ann Atwater was a person just like him, and so were other African Americans, and he tore up his Ku Klux Klan membership card in front of 1,000 people. He later became a very famous civil rights activist, a member of a janitors' union which was 70% African American. Now, to me, that story says, look, if we can understand the suffering that we share with another person, we can overcome even the most impossible divides. I mean, this guy was a KKK leader, and he changed.
Scientists have discovered that we're hardwired to be empathetic creatures. There's also an interesting experiment that you talk about in the book regarding primates and empathy.
That's right. Now, we have empathic brains. In fact, we've probably got a 10-section empathy circuit in our brains. And if you get part of it damaged, for example, in a car accident, you might lose your ability to recognize fear or other emotions on somebody else's face. A lot of neuroscientists talk about mirror neurons. These are neurons which light up not just when I feel pain, but when I see somebody else in pain. And it's part of the explanation of how we feel what other people feel. The same neurons are lighting up, are igniting. But I think the consensus currently is these mirror neurons are not the whole story. In fact, partly the research they come out of are based on a particular kind of monkey, which has lots of mirror neurons, but not very much empathy. You know, they're quite aggressive. But there are primates, most famously the bonobo chimp, which display extraordinary empathy both amongst themselves and with creatures from other species. And the great Dutch primatologist Frans de Waal, now works at Emory University, has done wonderful studies and written a great book called The Age of Empathy, where he shows how primates have natural inbuilt empathy, and that, of course, because we have a shared ancestry, this helps explain the innate human empathy we have as well. It's why a parent will respond to the cry of their infant, child in the crib. You know, it's why we form together as groups and will, help somebody without thinking sometimes, even at the cost of our own life sometimes.
You explain that empathy starts to develop in infancy, and it's vitally important to set the example as well as being loving and affectionate toward your children. But what happens if you did not receive affection or empathy as an example? Can you learn to be empathetic?
There is good news. You can learn to be more empathetic. The thing is that if in the first 2 years of life, what psychologists call attachment theory, they talk about how if you haven't had a lot of loving care and kindness from a caregiver, a parent, if you haven't had that in the first 2 years of life, you tend not to fully develop that affective empathy, that emotional mirroring you can have with other people. And that tends to be harder to develop later in life. But you can still particularly develop that cognitive empathy, that ability to try and step into somebody else's shoes. Like that story of Claiborne Paul Ellis, he was able to make a shift even as an adult. And these two kinds of empathy are closely linked, and we can develop or nurture these different kinds of empathy, but it's the cognitive empathy that we can do more of later on in life. But of course, the best thing to do is for parents to model empathy for their children. And it's something I try to do, sometimes struggling with my own kids.
Why did you want to study empathy? What led you down this path?
Oh, it's a fascinating question that, because in a way I have to give two completely different answers. I mean, one answer is that I used to be a college professor studying politics and sociology and things like that, and I had a realization that the way you change the world, the way you change society, is not just through elections and political parties, but it's about empathy, about creating relationships across social divides between men and women, young and old, in a kind of face-to-face way, that this is really how you change a society from the ground up. But I had another realization. Many years after I'd already embarked on studying empathy, I was sitting in my study, in fact, where I am now in the UK, and I had this momentary realization that when I was 10 years old and my mother died of breast cancer, I kind of lost my empathy. I lost an ability to really feel what others feel, to step into their shoes. I became very unemotional. I didn't cry or even laugh much after her death. And what I realized, the kind of epiphany, was that all my studies of empathy have been an attempt to recover that empathic self that I lost as a child. In a way, I think that's been the underlying or the unconscious motive for me for all the talks I give around the world and the book I've just written and the museum I've just founded. It's actually quite a personal motivation.
So what you're describing with your withdrawal was a defense mechanism.
Absolutely. And I think it's a very common trauma response. In fact, two things happened to me when my mum died. One is that I lost most of my memories from before that age. So I remember almost nothing. And that is quite common. And the other thing is this emotional distancing. I didn't have it in a very extreme form, but it was something that was certainly noticeable. And so I think these are a kind of mechanisms to help us cope. But the other classic mechanism, which I developed in a fairly mild way as well, is obsessive compulsive disorders. Again, it was some years afterwards I realized, oh, the reason I kept on checking the gas on the stove or the door lock was actually that's what helped me survive my mother's death. It was actually very useful at the time to have that.
And how are you now?
Now I don't have any of those things, but I've had to make this conscious effort of trying to connect with other people. And it's been a wonderful journey. I've had moments in my own life where I've been able to realize that I've made empathic leaps, not in some superhuman way, but in ways that have been important to me. So, for example, around the corner from where I live, there was this homeless guy who I used to walk past for years and years, and I never thought I had much in common with him. He was always walking around with bare feet in the snow and mumbling to himself in a kind of mad way. And one day I stopped to talk with him, and it challenged all my assumptions about homelessness and mental illness, because this guy, whose name turned out to be the rather unusual Alan Human, he turned out he had a philosophy degree from Oxford University, and we developed a friendship based on our interest in moral philosophy and pepperoni pizza. And it was a great moment in my own life, because it's about having curiosity about strangers. It opens us up to challenging our own assumptions and prejudices we have about people. In many ways, I learned a lot of this from the oral historian Studs Terkel as well, who always said that, everyone's an expert on their own experience, and we've got stuff to learn from other people. Other people are more interesting than ourselves. And I think some of the great, oral history and radio interviewers and so on really have that curiosity.
We've been talking about experiences that it's hard to imagine being in yourself. It's hard to imagine being paralyzed by severe depression if you've never been severely depressed. It's hard to imagine losing a child if you've never lost one. How do we begin to be empathetic?
I think there's two keys to that, because of course we can't replicate every experience that other people have gone through. I think one thing is through practicing the art of conversation, and I do think that having a conversation with a stranger at least once a week is very good for your empathic health, because hearing people's stories and listening to people's stories and not interrupting them all the time is a great way of opening yourself to other people's lived experience. But I think there's another thing that you can do, which is probably less challenging, which is you can practice empathy from your armchair. You can sit on your sofa at home and watch films and read novels and things like that, which catapult you into somebody else's mind. We all know that literature and film can help us make empathic journeys. I mean, what's the central line of To Kill a Mockingbird? It's you never really understand another person until you step inside his skin and walk around in it for a while. And with that in mind, I founded an online project not long ago called the Empathy Library at empathylibrary.com, where anyone can go along and find books and films reviewed on the theme of empathy, of stepping into other people's shoes. And there are top 10 lists, and you can add your own reviews. And there's things like To Kill a Mockingbird, there's great films as well. And these are all ways of taking a bit of an empathic adventure from our own homes.
And these are listed in the back of the book as well.
That's right. There's some listed in the back of the book. And in fact, in the book, I talk about some of the great films which catapult us into other people's lives. I mean, one of my favorites is a war film, All Quiet on the Western Front, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture back in 1930. And what was extraordinary about it was that it was an anti-war film, but it was a war film about the First World War made by Hollywood producers, but told from the perspective of a German soldier. You step into the shoes of this German soldier, and it's full of moments of understanding between soldiers from both sides of the conflict. And it's a great way of making us think about warfare today. What does it mean, whether it's in Afghanistan or civil war in Syria? It helps expand our minds. So I think those kinds of films can be very, very powerful.
Before I let you go, can we talk for a second about empathic listening?
Yeah, I think if you are in a situation where you're arguing with your partner or your husband or your wife, we've all been in those situations where we thought, oh God, I wish they could just see where I'm coming from, understand my point of view. You're asking for empathy, of course. And what empathy can do, if you practice empathic listening, is reduce conflict and tension in those personal situations, particularly. And the way you do it is by focusing on two things. What is the other person feeling? And what is the other person needing? If you can give them a chance to articulate their feelings and their needs, even if you can't agree on things, it's amazing how it reduces the tension. And that empathic listening, I think, is something we can all do a little bit of in an everyday way.
Thank you for your work, and thank you for coming on the show.
Well, and thank you for wonderful questions and for having looked at my book, and really thoughtful and interesting. And it's been great talking to you.
The book out in paperback is called Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It by Roman Kuznarek. Next, we'll look at the power of suggestion through hypnosis. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith. Hypnosis conjures up images of someone with a deep voice dangling a swinging object in front of us and saying things like, "You're getting very sleepy," rendering us spellbound and helpless. My guest, New Haven psychologist Dr. Mel Roy, will tell you it's not quite like that. Hypnosis or hypnotherapy creates a trance-like state that allows you to zoom in on a particular idea or suggestion with heightened awareness and focus. It's done with the guidance of a trained therapist using the power of words to walk you through mental images. It's through these images that a deep sense of calm and relaxation help provide an openness where the real work begins. And while you're more open to suggestion in this trance-like state, your behavior is never out of your control. Hypnosis has been used to curb behaviors like smoking and overeating, and to manage conditions like depression and chronic pain. The practice has been somewhat controversial since it first gained widespread use in the 1800s, but today it's being used more and more in mainstream medicine. Dr. Mel Roy is a practicing psychologist in New Haven and teaches seminars in hypnosis to psychiatry residents at Yale. He's used hypnotherapy as part of his practice for more than 30 years. He joins us in studio today. Thank you for coming in and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here.
Now, to be clear, that's not all you do. You also practice what we think of as traditional talk therapy. But we're focusing on hypnosis today. So what do you think of my description? Did I get it right?
Yes, I think that you got it basically right. And I would also say that hypnosis has really influenced everything that I do because it's helped me to develop my imagination. And so when I do what would be called more traditional therapy, I think in terms of images, metaphors, books that I have read, I draw from movies.
So give us an example.
Well, I might be working with someone who describes a particular problem, and then I remember a movie that I've seen, and there was a time when I would probably keep that to myself because I would think that that was irrelevant. What I realize is if someone just tells me something the way they might have said it many, many times before, and there are any number of people that have been to any number of other therapists, they are just doing the same thing that they've always done. So I see my purpose as in engaging their mind and opening their mind to other possibilities. And the way in which one does that is through one's imagination. And I call it one's unconscious mind.
Is there a story of a patient that comes to mind that you can talk about where they have overcome a challenge through hypnosis?
Well, I think of one very interesting woman that I work with. She had a phobia for driving over bridges. And unfortunately for her, her brother was in a hospital in New Jersey. And in order to visit him, she had to go over the Tappan Zee Bridge. The idea of doing that terrified her. And that's the reason why she came to see me. And as I do with all of my patients, I taught her a deep relaxation response. And so I was hoping that would be sufficient in order for her to be able to drive over the Pearl Harbor Memorial Bridge. And I take people out on the road in these instances. And so we went out on the road after I had taught her this relaxation response. And I saw as we were approaching the bridge that she was still very anxious. And so what I decided to do was I decided to put in her mind a stronger response than apparently the relaxation response brought about, and stronger than the anxiety that she experienced. So what we did was I told her to play her favorite rock song. We sang on the top of our voices, and she drove over the bridge. And so she replaced in her mind something that was stronger than she originally had there. And then she was able to visit her brother. In fact, the last time I heard from her, she sent me a video. She was driving across the Tappan Zee with her girlfriends, and they were all singing on the top of their voice. So it's a what we could call a true meeting of the minds.
You don't happen to remember what the song was, do you?
No, I don't. But I do remember this because I'm really an opera fan. On the way back, she also had a Pavarotti tape, and we played that.
I mentioned hypnosis has always been a little controversial. I'm imagining when you first started in this field, it was even more so. Is that the case?
Sure, because I think people are becoming more and more educated. But it's what you call a hot topic, and it's great to be working in a field where you have a hot topic.
Why do you think it is so controversial?
Well, because hypnosis is also used in other ways, especially for entertainment. And there are many examples of hypnosis in books and in TV. Dracula, according to the movie and the book, he's a master hypnotist. So it seems that when Dracula is there, he can get his victims to do anything that they wish. Huh. Hypnosis for entertainment really gives that impression, but it's still really not so. Then there's a sense that a stronger mind can overtake a weaker mind, and you can get that person to do or say anything you want. And that's not really true. The work that I do is a collaboration between my mind and the mind of somebody else. Then there's this other concern that once a person is put into trance, that he or she is going to give up their deepest and darkest secrets. That is not true either.
So what is really going on? How does hypnosis work in our minds?
Hypnosis enables us to go into that part of our mind which we use on an everyday level, but we are not necessarily used to calling it hypnotic. And I can give you the favorite example, and it's called a highway hypnosis. And what that means is you get into your car at point A, and you drive to point B, and you remember little or nothing about what happened. Your mind is on automatic pilot. What happens is that part of your mind is thinking about something. It could be anything. You're daydreaming, and your mind is focused. We call that your conscious mind. Then the other part of your mind takes over. That is what we call your unconscious mind. That is mostly right brain. That is the most powerful part of your mind. That is the part of your mind that knows everything that you know automatically. That is the part of your mind in which your emotions are kept. If you really wish to learn something deeply and effectively, that is the part of your mind where you want to be. Another very good example is the way in which TV commercials have changed. Many of them use hypnotic process of surprise, of imagination, and then the mind of the person who is watching the commercial may be ready to buy the product. For example, if I say, buy Zippo soap, the next time you go to the supermarket and you see Zippo on the shelf, you probably pass it by. But suppose I create a commercial in which you see beautiful people using Zippo soap in a rainforest lake. Then it's very possible, since I've helped you to enter the realm of your imagination, when you see Zippo soap, you will buy Zippo soap. So what we have to do in hypnosis is to engage that part of your mind in which your imagination is, in which the power of your creative mind resides. We're often told that we use just a small portion of our intellectual and creative process. When we enter into our creative mind, we're in the realm of virtual reality. And so you can think about this on an everyday level. Those of us that are like me, who are space cadets, are in their imagination a lot in daydreaming.
This is Dr. Mel Roy. He's a practicing psychologist in New Haven and has been using hypnotherapy as part of his practice for over 30 years. Hypnosis has been used to help curb behaviors like smoking or overeating and also to manage conditions like depression and chronic pain. What else has hypnosis been helpful with?
Well, for example, I was using my first example of a phobia, which is a severe anxiety reaction to a specific stimulus, a thing, or to a person. So when we're talking about anxiety, hypnosis is an excellent way of suppressing anxiety because you put something else in its place, which is usually a relaxation response. Hypnosis can be used for many creative things. I have worked with writers, musicians. I've worked with athletes. When you create the creative space in your mind to do the things that you need to do, you are, as we say, in the zone. And hypnosis is the method for doing that. Many people arrive at these things and use strategies very naturally. The wonderful thing about this is attaching mental processes that people already have and helping them to utilize those hypnotic processes to reach a goal. So generally, what I would say is there are many goals that people have, and there are things that stand in their way to reach those goals. Using a hypnotic process to empower them in many different situations results in the achievement of what they wish to accomplish.
Has hypnotherapy changed over the years?
Yes, it has. I think that's a very interesting question because hypnotic process and hypnotherapy goes all the way back to ancient times. It's mentioned in the Old Testament. In many old cultures and cultures that exist today, hypnosis is used, whether it's called hypnosis or not. We can talk about shamans, for example, and there are shamans that exist today. They use hypnosis, and that kind of breaks down a stereotype that we have of witch doctors. Today, things have become much more casual, and we realize people slip in and out of hypnotic process throughout the day. It could be just a word. It could be a song. We call these things anchors. Within a matter of seconds, you can go into a daydream. And so hypnotic process today is much more casual. So it has changed. It relies so much more on processes that engage the imagination.
Are there certain people, maybe certain personality types that are better suited for hypnosis?
Yes. There are some people that are extraordinarily talented. They could go through, for example, an operation such as an appendectomy without any medication. I have, in the past, I've worked with any number of women on natural childbirth. And some of them are so extraordinarily talented. And one wonderful example of that was a woman that I worked with for about 10 sessions, and we made some recordings giving her different strategies to learn how to relax. So the morning that she began to go into labor, she listened to the recording, but she also went about her business. And she became more and more focused as the contractions came closer together. Then she knew exactly when it was time. She calmly told her husband. They drove to the hospital. She was 9 centimeters dilated. She had her baby in 30 minutes without any medication. So that was my most successful case. She was very talented. Some people can sit in the dentist chair without any Novocaine, even if they're having a tooth extracted. I cannot do that, but I've learned, for example, that instead of clutching the arms of the chair, I look up into the light above and I breathe deeply and I put myself into a trance. And sometimes I've almost fallen asleep in the dentist chair. I hope my dentist is listening to this because I have an appointment on Monday. So yes, to answer your question, that was rather long-winded, but yes, there are many people who are talented. A erroneous way of looking at this is that it used to be said that there are many people who are very suggestible. And this is true, but it really is the talent of the imagination.
I picture therapists listening a lot, but if you're conducting hypnosis, then it occurs to me that you must be doing most of the talking.
Oh, well, hypnosis is a dance, leading and following. So it's a dialogue, but not necessarily the kind of dialogue I would have ordinarily with a patient if we were not doing hypnotic process. You see, the unconscious mind, very interestingly, works according to what we call conditioned responses. And anyone that's had a little elementary psychology remembers Pavlov. Pavlov had these laboratory dogs, which he, when he fed them, he sounded a bell every time. And what he noticed was all he needed to do was to sound the bell. And the dogs would react, salivate, as if they were going to be fed. That's how emotions work, and that's how the unconscious mind works. There are all these triggers that are associated with emotional reactions. When we learn what our triggers are, then we have a different concept of what control is. And that changes the stereotype. In other words, I could put it in the vernacular, when I know what sets me off, and if it sets me off in a negative way, I can put in my mind, either myself or with a therapist, things that are more powerful that suppress those negative responses. And when there is something wonderful in my mind, then I want to enhance that. If I were an athlete, if I were a singer or any kind of performer, I'd want to max that. I'd want to enliven my senses so I would be there in the moment in my imagination. And then when I actually was in the act of doing that, all of this would be in my mind and it would just flow out. And then I'm in the zone. Just like I'm talking now, I just realized, because this happens all the time because this is a conditioned response, it's like a window in my mind opens and all the things that I need are there. And I become very confident, very serene, and very much in the moment.
So what do you want people to know about hypnosis?
What I want them to know is that their unconscious mind is wonderful. That there are so many wonderful and positive things that everyone is capable of, that they have a magnificent amount of potential when they learn how to use it. And that imagination is just like a muscle. A muscle grows if you exercise it, and imagination grows when you allow yourself and give yourself permission to be in the imagination.
Well, this has been a fun conversation. Thank you for coming on the show.
And thank you for having me here.
Dr. Mel Roy is a practicing psychologist here in New Haven. He teaches seminars in hypnosis to psychiatry residents at Yale University and has been using hypnotherapy as part of his practice for more than 30 years. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening. Your imagination can make you see and